get a full meal. Soon enough, it'll be out there again.
It only prowls at night, Jamie said. You're sure of that much?
I am.
Does the moon have any effect on it? I asked.
Because my father's advisor, and our teacher that was, says that in some of the old legends...
I've heard the legends, Si, but in that they're wrong, at least for this particular creature they are. Sometimes the moon's been full when it strikes. It was full peddler when it showed up at Serenity, all covered with scales and knobs like an alligator from the long salt swamps. But it did its work at Timbersmith when the moon was dark. I'd like to tell you different, but I can't. I'd also like to end this without having to pick anyone else's guts out of the bushes or pluck some other kitty's head off on a fence post. You've been sent here to help, and I hope like hell you can, although I've got my doubts.
When I asked Peavy if there was a good hotel or boarding house in Debaria, he chuckled.
The last boarding house was the Widow Brayley's. 2 years ago, a drunk saddle tramp tried to rape her in her own outhouse as she sat at business. But she was always a trig one. She'd seen the look in his eye and went in there with a knife under her apron, cut his throat for him, she did. Stringy Bodine, who used to be our justice man before he decided to try his luck at raising horses in the Crescent, declared her not guilty by reason of self-defense in about 5 minutes, but the lady decided she'd had enough of Debaria and trained back to Gilead, where she yet bides, I've no doubt. 2 days after she left, some drunken buffoon burned the place to the ground. The hotel still stands. It's called the Delightful View. The view ain't delightful, young fellows, and the beds is full of bugs as big as toad's eyeballs. I wouldn't sleep in one without putting on a full suit of Arthur Eld's armor.
And so we ended up spending our first night in Debaria, in the large, drunk and disorderly cell beneath Peavy's chalked map. Salty Sam had been set free, and we had the jail to ourselves. Outside, a strong wind had begun to blow off the alkali flats to the west of town. The moaning sound it made around the eaves caused me to think again of the story my mother used to read to me when I was just a small toot myself. The story of Tim Stoutheart and the stark blast Tim had to face in the great woods north of New Canaan. Thinking of the boy alone in those woods has always chilled my heart, just as Tim's bravery has always warmed it. The stories we hear in childhood are the ones we remember all our lives. After one particularly strong gust, the Devaria wind was warm, not cold like the stark blast, struck the side of the jail and puffed alkali grit in through the barred window. Jamie spoke up. It was rare for him to start a conversation. "I hate that sound, Roland. It's apt to keep me awake all night." "I loved it myself. The sound of the wind has always made me think of good times and far places, although I confess I could have done without the grit." "How are we supposed to find this thing, Jamie? I hope you have some idea, because I don't." "We'll have to talk to the salt miners. That's the place to start. Someone may have seen a fellow with blood on him creeping back to where the salties live, creeping back naked, for he can't come back clothed unless he takes them off beforehand." That gave me a little hope, although if the one we were looking for knew what he was, he might take his clothes off when he felt an attack coming on, hide them, then come back to them later. But if he didn't know... It was a small thread, but sometimes, if you're careful not to break it, you can pull on a small thread and unravel a whole garment. "Good night, Roland."
"Good night, Jamie."
I closed my eyes and thought of my mother. I often did that year, but for once they weren't thoughts of how she had looked dead, but of how beautiful she had been in my early childhood, as she sat beside me on my bed in the room with the colored glass windows, reading to me. "Look you, Roland," she'd say, "here are the billy bumblers sitting all a row and scenting the air. They know, don't they?" "Yes," I would say, "the bumblers know." "And what is it they know?" the woman I would kill asked me. "What is it they know, dear heart?" "They know the stark blast is coming," I said. My eyes would be growing heavy by then, and minutes later I would drift off to the music of her voice.
as I drifted off now, with the wind outside blowing up a strong gale. I woke in the first thin light of morning to a harsh sound. Brung, brung, brung. Jamie was still flat on his back, legs splayed, snoring. I took one of my revolvers from its holster, went out through the open cell door, and shambled toward that imperious sound. It was the jing-jang Sheriff Peavy had taken so much pride in. He wasn't there to answer it. He'd gone home to bed, and the office was empty. Standing there, bare-chested, with a gun in my hand and wearing nothing but the swabbies and slinkum I'd slept in, for it was hot in the cell, I took the listening cone off the wall, put the narrow end in my ear, and leaned close to the speaking tube. "Yes? Hello?" "Who the hell's this?" a voice screamed, so loud that it sent a nail of pain into the side of my head. There were jing-jangs in Gilead, perhaps as many as 100 that still worked, but none spoke so clear as this. I pulled the cone away, wincing, and could still hear the voice coming out of it. "Hello? Hello? God's curse this fucking thing! Hello?" "I hear you," I said. "Lower thy voice, for your father's sake." "Who is this?" There was just enough drop in volume for me to put the listening cone a little closer to my ear, but not in it. I would not make that mistake twice. "A deputy." Jamie DeCurry and I were the farthest things in the world from that, but simplest is usually best, always best, I wot, when speaking with a panicky man on a jing-jang. "Where's Sheriff Peavy?" "At home, with his wife. It isn't yet 5 o'clock, I reckon. Now tell me who you are, where you're speaking from, and what's happened." "It's Canfield of the Jefferson." "Of the Jefferson what?" I heard footsteps behind me and turned, half-raising my revolver. But it was only Jamie, with his hair standing up in sleep spikes all over his head. He was holding his own gun and had gotten into his jeans, although his feet were yet bare. "The Jefferson Ranch, you great grotting idiot! You need to get the sheriff out here and gin-gin. Everyone's dead. Jefferson, his family, the cookie, all the proddies. Blood from one end to other." "How many?" I asked. "Maybe 15? Maybe 20? Who can tell?" Canfield of the Jefferson began to sob. "They're all in pieces. Whatever it was did for 'em left the two dogs, Rosie and Mosey. They was in there. We had to shoot 'em. They was lapping up the blood and eating the brains." It was a 10-wheel ride straight north toward the Salt Hills. We went with Sheriff Peavy, Kellen Fry, the good deputy, and Fry's son, Vicka. The NG, whose name turned out to be Travis, also came along, for he'd spent the night at the Fry's place. We pushed our mounts hard, but it was still full daylight by the time we got to the Jefferson spread. At least the wind, which was still strengthening, was at our backs. Peavy thought Canfield was a pokey, which is to say, a wandering cowboy not signed to any particular ranch. Some such turned outlaw, but most were honest enough, just men who couldn't settle down in one place. When we rode through the wide stock gate with Jefferson posted over it in white birch letters, two other cowboys, his mates, were with him. The three of them were bunched together by the shake-pole fence of the horse corral, which stood near the big house. A half a mile or so north, standing atop a little hill, was the bunkhouse. From this distance, only two things looked out of place. The door at the south end of the bunkie was unlatched, swinging back and forth in the alkali wind, and the bodies of two large black dogs lay stretched on the dirt. We dismounted, and Sheriff Peavy shook with the men, who looked mightily glad to see us. "Aye, Bill Canfield, see you very well, pokey fella." The tallest of them took off his hat and held it against his shirt. "I ain't no pokey no more, or maybe I am, I don't know. For a while here I was Canfield of the Jefferson, like I told whoever answered the goddamn speaky, because I signed on just last month. Old man Jefferson himself oversaw my mark on the wall, but now he's dead like the rest of 'em." He swallowed hard. His Adam's apple bobbed up and down. The stubble on his face looked very black because his skin was very white. There was drying vomit on the front of his shirt. His wife and daughters have gone into the clearing, too. You can tell them by their long hair and their... hair. Man, Jesus, you see a thing like that and it makes you wish you were born blind. He raised his hat to his face to hide it and began to weep. One of Canfield's mates said, "Is those gunslingers, Sheriff? Mighty young to be hauling iron, ain't they?"
"Never mind them," said Peavy. "Tell me what brought you here."
Canfield lowered his hat. His eyes were red and streaming. "The three of us was camped out on the pure. Roundin' strays we were, and camped for the night. Then we heard screamin' start from the east, woke us from a sound sleep because we was that tired. Then gunshots, two or three of 'em. They quit, and there was more screamin', and something big, roarin' and snarlin'." One of the others said,
"Soundin' like a bear."
"No, it didn't," said the third, "never at all."
Canfield said, "Knew it was coming from the ranch, whatever it was. Had to have been 4 wheels from where we were, maybe 6, but sound carries on the pure, as you know. We mounted up, but I got here way ahead of these two because I was signed and they're yet pokies."
"I don't understand," I said.
Canfield turned to me.
"I had a ranch horse, didn't I? A good un. Snip and Arn there had nothing but mules. Put 'em in there with the others."
He pointed into the corral. A big gust of wind blew through just then, driving dust before it, and all the livestock galloped away like a wave.
"They're still spooked," Kellen Fry said. Looking toward the bunkhouse, the NG, Travis said, "They ain't the only ones."
By the time Canfield, the Jefferson Ranch's newest proddy, which is to say, hired hand, reached the home place, the screaming had stopped. So had the roaring of the beast, although there was still a good deal of snarling going on. That was the two dogs fighting over the leavings. Knowing which side of the biscuit his honey went on, Canfield bypassed the bunkhouse and the dogs snarling within for the big house. The front door was wide open, and there were lit seniors in both the hall and the kitchen, but no one answered his hail. He found Jefferson's lady Si in the kitchen with her body under the table and her half-eaten head rolled up against the pantry door. There were tracks going out the stoop door, which was banging in the wind. Some were human, some were the tracks of a monstrous great bear. The bear tracks were bloody.
"I took the senior off a sink side where it had been left and followed the tracks outside. The two girls was a-layin' in the dirt between the house and the barn. One had gotten 3 or 4 dozen running steps ahead of her Sissa, but they were both just as dead with their nightdresses torn off 'em and their backs carved open right down to the spines."
Canfield shook his head slowly from side to side, his large eyes, swimming with tears they were, never leaving High Sheriff Peavy's face.
"I never want to see the claws that could do a thing like that. Never, never, never in my life. I seen what they done, and that's enough."
"The bunkhouse?" Peavy asked.
"Aye, there I went next. You can see what's inside for yourself. The womenfolk, too, for they're still where I found 'em. I won't take ye. Snip and Arn might
not me," said Snip.
"Me neither," said Arn. "I'll see 'en in my dreams, and that'll do me fine."
"I don't think we need a guide," Peavy said. "You three boys, stay right here."
Sheriff Peavy, closely followed by the Fries and Travis the Engie, started toward the big house. Jamie put a hand on Peavy's shoulder and spoke almost apologetically when the High Sheriff turned to look at him. "Mind the tracks. They'll be important." Peavy nodded.
"Yar, we'll mind them very well, especially those headed off to wherever the thing went."
The women were as Si Canfield had told us. I had seen bloodshed before, aye, plenty of it, both in Magus and in Gilead, but I had never seen anything like this, and neither had Jamie. He was as pale as Canfield, and I could only hope he would not discredit his father by passing out. I needn't have worried. Soon he was down on his knees in the kitchen, examining several enormous blood-rimmed animal tracks. "These really are bear tracks," he said, "but there never was one so big, Roland. Not even in the endless forest."
"There was one here last night, Cully," Travis said.
He looked toward the body of the rancher's wife and shivered, even though she, like her unfortunate daughters, had been covered with blankets from upstairs.
"I'll be glad to get back to Gilead, where such things are just legends."
"What did the tracks tell otherwise?" I asked Jamie. "Anything?" "Yes. It went to the bunkhouse first, where the most food was. The rumpus would have wakened the four of them here in the house. Were there only four, Sheriff?"
"Aye," Peavy said. "There are two sons, but Jefferson would have sent them to the auctions in Gilead, I expect. They'll find a sack of wool when they return."
The rancher left his womenfolk and went running for the bunkhouse. The gun Canfield and his mates heard must have been his. "Much good it did him," Vicar Fry said. His father hit him on the shoulder and told him to hush. "Then the thing came up here," Jamie went on. "The lady Cy Jefferson and the two girls were in the kitchen by then, I think, and I think the Cy must have told her daughters to run."
"Aye," Peavy said, "and she'd try to keep it from coming after them long enough for them to get away. That's how it reads. Only it didn't work. If they'd been at the front of the house, if they'd seen how big it was, she'd have known better, and we would have found all three of them out there in the dirt."
He fetched a deep sigh.
"Come on, boys. Let's see what's in the bunkhouse. Waiting won't make it any prettier."
"I think I might stay out by the corral with those saddle tramps," Travis said. "I've seen enough." Vicar Fry blurted, "Can I do that too, Pa?" Kellen looked at his son's haunted face and said he could. Before he let the boy go, he put a kiss on his cheek. 10 feet or so in front of the bunkhouse, the bare earth had been scuffed into a bloody churn of boot prints and clawed animal tracks. Nearby, in a clump of jugweed, was an old short-arm foreshot with its barrel bent to one side. Jamie pointed from the confusion of tracks to the gun to the open bunkhouse door. Then he raised his eyebrows, silently asking me if I saw it. I saw it very well. "This is where the thing, the skin man wearing the shape of a bear, met the rancher," I said. "He got off a few rounds, then dropped the gun." "No," Jamie said. "The thing took it from him. That's why the barrel's bent. Maybe Jefferson turned to run, maybe he stood his ground. Either way, it did no good. His tracks stop here, so the thing picked him up and threw him through that door and into the bunkhouse. It went to the big house next."
"So, we're backtracking it," Peavy said.
Jamie nodded. "We'll front-track it soon enough," he said. The thing had turned the bunkhouse into an abattoir. In the end, the butcher's bill came to 18. 16 proddies, the cook, who had died beside his stove with his rent and blood-stained apron thrown over his face like a shroud, and Jefferson himself, who had been torn limbless. His severed head stared up at the rafters with a fearful grin that showed only his top teeth. The skin man had ripped the rancher's lower jaw right out of his mouth. Kellen Fry found it under a bunk. One of the men had tried to defend himself with a saddle, using it as a shield, but it had done him no good. The thing had torn it in half with its claws. The unfortunate cowboy was still holding onto the pommel with one hand. He had no face. The thing had eaten it off his skull.
"Roland," Jamie said.
His voice was strangled, as if his throat had closed up to no more than a straw.
"We have to find this thing. We have to."
"Let's see what the outward tracks say before the wind wipes them out," I replied. We left Peavy and the others outside the bunkhouse and circled the big house to where the covered bodies of the two girls lay. The tracks beyond them had begun to blur at the edges and around the claw points, but they would have been hard to miss even for someone not fortunate enough to have had Court of Gilead as a teacher. The thing that made them must have weighed upwards of 800 pounds. "Look here," Jamie said, kneeling beside one. "See how it's deeper at the front? It was running." "And on its hind legs," I said, "like a man." The tracks went past the pump house, which was in shambles, as if the thing had given it a swipe out of pure malice as it went by. They led us onto an uphill lane that headed north, toward a long, unpainted outbuilding that was either a tack shed or a smithy. Beyond this, perhaps 20 wheels farther north, were the rocky badlands below the salt hills. We could see the holes that led to the worked-out mines. They gaped like empty eye sockets. "We may as well give this up," I said. "We know where the tracks go, up to where the Salties live." "Not yet," Jamie said. "Look here, Roland. You've never seen anything like this." The tracks began to change, the claws merging into the curved shapes of large, unshod hooves. "It lost its bear shape," I said, "and became..." "What, a bull?" "I think so," Jamie said. "Let's go a little further. I have an idea." As we approached the long outbuilding, the hoof prints became paw prints. The bull had become some kind of monstrous cat. These tracks were large at first, then started to grow smaller, as if the thing were shrinking from the size of a lion to that of a cougar, even as it ran. When they veered off the lane and onto the dirt path leading to the tack shed, we found a large patch of jugweed grass that had been beaten down. The broken stalks were bloody. "It fell," Jamie said. "I think it fell, and then thrashed." He looked up from the bed of matted weed. His face was thoughtful. "I think it was in pain." "Good," I said. "Now, look there." I pointed to the path, which was imprinted with the hooves of many horses, and other signs as well. Bare feet going to the doors of the building, which were run back on rusty metal tracks. Jamie turned to me, wide-eyed. I put my finger to my lips and drew one of my revolvers. Jamie did likewise, and we moved toward the shed. I waved him around to the far side. He nodded and split off to the left. I stood outside the open doors, gun held up, giving Jamie time to get to the other end of the building. I heard nothing. When I judged my pard must be in place, I bent down, picked up a good-sized stone with my free hand, and tossed it inside. It thumped, then rolled across wood. There was still nothing else to hear. I swung inside, crouched low, gun at the ready. The place seemed empty, but there were so many shadows it was at first hard to tell for sure. It was already warm, and by noonday would be an oven. I saw a pair of empty stalls on either side, a little smithy stove next to drawers full of rusty shoes and equally rusty shoe nails, dust-covered jugs of liniment and stinkum, branding irons in a tin sleeve, and a large pile of old tack that needed either to be mended or thrown out. Above a couple of benches hung a fair assortment of tools on pegs. Most were as rusty as the shoes and nails. There were a few wooden hitching hooks and a pedestal pump over a cement trough. The water in the trough hadn't been changed for a while. As my eyes adjusted to the dimness, I could see bits of straw floating on the surface. I kenned that this had once been more than a tack shed. It had also been a kind of hostelry where the ranch's working stock was seen to, likely a jackleg veterinary as well. Horses could be let in at one end, dealt with, and let out the other, but it looked in disrepair, abandoned. The tracks of the thing that had by then been human led up the center aisle to other doors, also open at the far end. I followed them. "Jamie, it's me. Don't shoot me for your father's sake." I stepped outside. Jamie had holstered his gun and now pointed at a large heap of horse apples. "He knows what he is, Roland. You know this from a pile of horse shit?" "As happens, I do." He didn't tell me how, but after a few seconds I saw it for myself. The hostelry had been abandoned, probably in favor of one built closer into the main house, but the horse apples were fresh. If he came a horseback, he came as a man. Aye, and left as one. I squatted on my hunkers and thought about this. Jamie rolled a smoke and let me. When I looked up, he was smiling a little. "Do you see what it means, Roland?"
200 salties, give or take, I said. I've ever been slow, but in the end I usually get there.
Aye?
Salties, mind. Not pokies or proddies. Diggers, not riders, as a rule.
As you say.
How many of them up there have horses, do you suppose? How many of them even know how to ride?
His smile broadened. There might be 20 or 30, I suppose.
It's better than 200, I said. Better by a long stride. We'll go up as soon as...
I never finished what I was going to say, because that's when the moaning started. It was coming from the tack shed I'd dismissed as empty. How glad I was at that moment Court wasn't there. He would have cuffed my ear and sent me sprawling. At least, in his prime he would have. Jamie and I looked into each other's startled eyes, then ran back inside. The moaning continued, but the place looked as empty as before. Then that big heap of old tack, busted hames, bridles, cinch straps, and reins, started to heave up and down, as if it were breathing. The tangled bunches of leather began to tumble away to either side, and from them a boy was born. His white blonde hair was sticking up in all directions. He wore jeans and an old shirt that hung open and unbuttoned. He didn't look hurt, but in the shadows it was hard to tell.
"Is it gone?" he asked in a trembling voice. "Please, Si, say it is. Say it's gone."
"It is," I said. He started to wade his way out of the pile, but a strip of leather had gotten wound around one of his legs, and he fell forward. I caught him and saw a pair of eyes, bright blue and utterly terrified, looking up into my face. Then he passed out. I carried him to the trough. Jamie pulled off his bandana, dipped it in the water, and began to wipe the boy's dirt-streaked face with it. He might have been 11. He might have been a year or two younger. He was so thin it was hard to tell. After a bit, his eyes fluttered open. He looked from me to Jamie and then back to me again.
"Who are you?" he asked. "You don't belong to the ranch."
"We're friends of the ranch," I said. "Who are you?"
"Bill Streeter," he said. "The proddies call me Young Bill."
"Aye, do they? And is your father Old Bill?" He sat up, took Jamie's bandana, dipped it in the trough, and squeezed it out so the water ran down his thin chest.
"No, Old Bill's my grandther. Went into the clearing 2 years ago. My da, he's just plain Bill."
Something about speaking his father's name made his eyes widen. He grasped my arm.
"He ain't dead, is he? Say he ain't, Si."
Jamie and I exchanged another look, and that scared him worse than ever.
"Say he ain't. Please say my daddy ain't dead."
He started to cry.
"Hush, and go easy now," I said. "What is he, your da, proddy?"
"Nay, no, he's the cook. Say he ain't dead."
But the boy knew he was. I saw it in his eyes as clearly as I'd seen the bunkhouse cook with his blood-stained apron thrown over his face. There was a willow tree on one side of the big house, and that was where we questioned Young Bill Streeter, just me, Jamie, and Sheriff Peavy. The others we sent back to wait in the shade of the bunkhouse, thinking that to have too many folks around him would only upset the boy more. As it happened, he could tell us very little of what we needed to know. My da said to me that it was going to be a warm night, and I should go up to the Grays t'other side of the corral and sleep under the stars, Young Bill told us. He said it'd be cooler and I'd sleep better, but I knew why. Elrod had gotten a bottle somewhere, again, and he was in drink.
That'd be Elrod Nutter? Sheriff Peavy asked.
Aye, him. Foreman of the boys, he is.
I know him well, Peavy said to us. Ain't I had him locked up half a dozen times and more? Jefferson keeps him on because he's a hell of a rider and roper, but he's one mean whore dog when he's in drink. Ain't he, Young Bill?
Young Bill nodded earnestly and brushed his long hair, still dusty from all the tack he'd hidden in, out of his eyes.
Yes, sir, and he had a way of taking after me, which my father knew.
Cook's apprentice, were ye? Peavy asked.
I knew he was trying to be kind, but I wish he'd mind his mouth and stop talking in the way that says once, but no more. But the boy didn't seem to notice. Bunkhouse boy, not cook's boy. He turned to Jamie and me. I make the bunks, coil the rope, cinch the bedrolls, polish the saddle, set the gates at the end of the day after the horses is turned in. Tiny Braddock taught me how to make a lasso, and I throw it pretty. Roscoe's teaching me the bow. Freddy Two-Step says he'll show me how to brand come fall. Do well, I said, and tapped my throat. That made him smile. They're good fellas, mostly. The smile went away as fast as it had come, like the sun going behind a cloud. Except for Elrod. He's just grouchy when he's sober, but when he's in drink, he likes to tease. Mean teasing, if you do Kennet. Kennet well, I said. Aye, and if you don't laugh and act like it's all a joke, even if it's twisting on your hand or yanking you around on the bunkhouse floor by your hair, he gets uglier still. So when my da told me to sleep out, I took my blanket and my shaddy and I went. A word to the wise is sufficient, my da says. What's a shaddy? Jamie asked the sheriff.
Bit of canvas, Peavy said. Won't keep off the rain, but it'll keep you from getting damp after dewfall.
Where did you roll in? I asked the boy. He pointed beyond the corral, where the horses were still skiddy from the rising wind. Above us and around us, the willow sighed and danced. Pretty to hear, prettier still to look at. I guess my blanket and shaddy must still be there. I looked from where he had pointed, to the tack shed hostelry where we'd found him, then to the bunkhouse. The three places made the corners of a triangle, probably a quarter mile on each side, with the corral in the middle.
How did you get from where you slept to hiding under that pile of tack, Bill? Sheriff Peavy asked.
The boy looked at him for a long time without speaking. Then the tears began to fall again. He covered them with his fingers so we wouldn't see them. I don't remember, he said. I don't remember nothing. He didn't exactly lower his hands. They seemed to drop into his lap, as if they'd grown too heavy for him to hold up. I want my da. Jamie got up and walked away with his hands stuffed deep in his back pockets. I tried to say what needed saying and couldn't. You have to remember that although Jamie and I wore guns, they weren't yet the big guns of our fathers. I'd never again be so young as before I met Susan Delgado and loved her and lost her, but I was still too young to tell this boy that his father had been torn to pieces by a monster. So I looked to Sheriff Peavy. I looked to the grown-up. Peavy took off his hat and laid it aside on the grass. Then he took the boy's hands.
Son, he said, I've got some very hard news for you. I want you to pull in a deep breath and be a man about it.
But young Bill Streeter had only 9 or 10 summers behind him, 11 at most, and he couldn't be a man about anything. He began to wail. When he did it, I saw my mother's pale, dead face, as clear as if she had been lying next to me under that willow, and I couldn't stand it. I felt like a coward, but that didn't stop me from getting up and walking away. The lad either cried himself to sleep or into unconsciousness. Jamie carried him into the big house and put him in one of the beds upstairs. He was just the son of a bunkhouse cook, but there was no one else to sleep in them. Not now. Sheriff Peavy used the jing-jang to call his office, where one of the not-so-good deputies had been ordered to wait for his ring. Soon enough, DeBaria's undertaker, if there was one, would organize a little convoy of wagons to come and pick up the dead. Sheriff Peavy went into Cy Jefferson's little office and plunked himself down in a chair on rollers.
"What's next, boys?" he asked. "The salties, I reckon, and I suppose you'll want to get up there before this wind blows into a simoom, which it certainly means to do."
He sighed.
"The boy's no good to ye, that's certain. Whatever he saw was evil enough to scrub his mind clean."
Jamie began, "Roland has a way of—" "I'm not sure what's next," I said. "I'd like to talk it over a little with my pard. We might take a little passier back up to that tack shed."
"Packs'll be blown away by now," Peavy said, "but have at it, and may it do you well."
He shook his head.
Telling that boy was hard. Very hard.
"You did it the right way," I said.
"Do you think so?" "Aye. Well, thank you, poor little Cully. Reckon he can stay with me and the wife for a while, until we figure what comes next for him. You boys go on and palaver if it suits you. I think I'll just sit here and try to get back even with myself. No hurry about anything now. That damn thing ate well enough last night. It'll be a good while before it needs to go hunting again."
Jamie and I walked two circuits around the shed and corral while we talked, the strengthening wind rippling our pant legs and blowing back our hair. "Is it all truly erased from his mind, Roland?"
"What do you think?" I asked.
"No," he said, "because is it gone?" was the first thing he asked. And he knew his father was dead. Even when he asked us, it was in his eyes. Jamie walked without replying for a while, his head down. We'd tied our bandanas over our mouths and noses because of the blowing grit. Jamie's was still wet from the trough. Finally, he said, "When I started to tell the sheriff you have a way of getting at things that are buried in people's minds, you cut me off. He doesn't need to know because it doesn't always work." It had with Susan Delgado in Magus, but part of Susan had wanted badly to tell me what the witch, Rhea, had tried to hide from Susan's front mind, where we hear our own thoughts very clearly. She'd wanted to tell me because we were in love. "But will you try? You will, won't you?" I didn't answer him until we had started our second circuit of the corral. I was still putting my thoughts in order. As I may have said, that has always been slow work for me. The Salties don't live in the mines anymore. They have their own encampment a few wheels west of Little Debaria. Kellen Fry told me about it on the ride out here. I want you to go up there with Peavy and the Fries. Canfield, too, if he'll go. I think he will. Those two pokies, Canfield's trail mates, can stay here and wait for the undertaker.
You mean to take the boy back to town?
Yes, alone. But I'm not sending you up there just to get you and the others away. If you travel fast enough and they have a remuda, you may still be able to spot a horse that's been rode hard. Under the bandana, he might have smiled.
I doubt it.
I did, too. It would have been more likely, but for the wind, what Peavy had called the simoom. It would dry the sweat on a horse, even one that had been ridden hard, in short order. Jamie might spot one that was dustier than the rest, one with burdocks and bits of jugweed in its tail. But if we were right about the skin man knowing what he was, he would have given his mount a complete rubdown and curry from hooves to mane as soon as he got back.
Someone may have seen him ride in.
Yes, unless he went to Little Debaria first, cleaned up, and came back to the Salty encampment from there. A clever man might do that. Even so, you and the sheriff should be able to find out how many of them own horses.
And how many of them can ride, even if they don't own, Jamie said.
Aye, we can do that.
Round that bunch up, I told him, or as many of them as you can, and bring them back to town. Any who protests, remind them that they'll be helping to catch the monster that's been terrorizing Debaria, Little Debaria, the whole barony. You won't have to tell them that any who still refuse will be looked at with extra suspicion. Even the dumbest of them will know.
Jamie nodded, then grabbed the fence rail as an especially strong gust of wind blasted us. I turned to face him.
And one other thing. You're going to pull a cozy, and Kellen's son, Vicka, will be your cat's paw. They'll believe a kid might run off at the mouth, even if he's been told not to.
Especially if he's been told not to.
Jamie waited, but I felt sure he knew what I was going to say, for his eyes were troubled. It was a thing he'd never have done himself, even if he thought of it, which was why my father had put me in charge. Not because I'd done well in Magus, I hadn't, not really, and not because I was his son, either. Although, in a way, I suppose that was it. My mind was like his. Cold. You'll tell the Salties who know about horses that there was a witness to the murder at the ranch. You'll say you can't tell them who it was, naturally, but that he saw the skin man in his human form. You don't know that young Bill actually saw him, Roland. And even if he did, he might not have seen the face. He was hiding in a pile of tack, for your father's sake. That's true, but the skin man won't know it's true. All the skin man will know is that it might be true, because he was human when he left the ranch. I began to walk again, and Jamie walked beside me. Now, here's where Vicar comes in. He'll get separated from you and the others a bit, and whisper to someone, another kid, one his own age would be best, that the survivor was the cook's boy, Bill Streeter by name. The boy just lost his father, and now you want to use him as bait. It may not come to that. If the story gets to the right ears, the one we're looking for may bolt on the way to town. Then you'll know. And none of it matters if we're wrong about the skin man being a Salty. We could be, you know. What if we're right and the fellow decides to face it out? Bring them all to the jail. I'll have the boy in a cell, a locked one, you can. And you can walk the horsemen past, one by one. I'll tell young Bill to say nothing, one way or the other, until they're gone. You're right. He may not be able to pick our man out, even if I can help him remember some of what happened last night. But our man won't know that either. It's risky, said Jamie. Risky for the kid. Small risk, I said. It'll be daylight, with the skin man in his human shape. And Jamie, I grasped his arm, I'll be in the cell too. The bastard will have to go through me if he wants to get to the boy. Peavy liked my plan better than Jamie had. I wasn't a bit surprised. It was his town, after all. And what was young Bill to him? Only the son of a dead cook. Not much in the great scheme of things. Once the little expedition to Salty Town was on its way, I woke the boy and told him we were going to DeBaria. He agreed without asking questions. He was distant and dazed. Every now and then, he rubbed his eyes with his knuckles. As we walked out to the corral, he asked me again if I was sure his Da was dead. I told him I was. He fetched a deep sigh, lowered his head, and put his hands on his knees. I gave him time, then asked if he'd like me to saddle a horse for him. If it's all right to ride Millie, I can saddle her myself. I feed her, and she's my special friend. People say mules ain't smart, but Millie is. Let me see if you can do it without getting kicked, I said. It turned out he could, and smartly. He mounted up and said, I guess I'm ready. He even tried to give me a smile. It was awful to look at. I was sorry for the plan I'd set in motion, but all I had to do was think of the carnage we were leaving behind, and Sister Fortuna's ruined face to remind me of what the stakes were. Will she skid in the wind? I asked, nodding at the trim little mule. Sitting on its back, young Bill's feet came almost down to the ground. In another year he'd be too big for her, but of course, in another year he'd probably be far from DeBaria, just another wanderer on the face of a fading world. Millie would be a memory. Not Millie, he said. She's as solid as a dromedary. Aye, and what's a dromedary? Dunno, do I? It's just something my dad says. One time I asked him, and he didn't know either. Come on, then, I said. The sooner we get to town, the sooner we get out of this grit. But I intended to make one stop before we got to town. I had something to show the boy while we were still alone. About halfway between the ranch and DeBaria, I spied a deserted sheepherder's lean-to and suggested we shelter in there for a bit and have a bite. Bill Streeter agreed willingly enough. He had lost his Da and everyone else he'd known, but he was still a growing boy, and he'd had nothing to eat since his dinner the night before. We tethered our mounts away from the wind and sat on the floor inside the lean-to with our backs against the wall. I had dried beef wrapped in leaves in my saddlebag. The meat was salty, but my water skin was full. The boy ate half a dozen chunks of the meat, tearing off big bites and washing them down with water. A strong gust of wind shook the lean-to,
Millie batted a protest and fell silent. "It'll be a full-going simoom by dark," young Bill said. "You watch and see if it ain't." "I like the sound of the wind," I said. "It makes me think of a story my mother read to me when I was a small one, The Wind Through the Keyhole, it was called. Does thee know it?" Young Bill shook his head. "Mister, are you really a gunslinger? Say true?"
"I am."
"Can I hold one of your guns for a minute?"
"Never in life," I said. "But you can look at one of these if you like."
I took a shell from my belt and handed it to him. He examined it closely from brass base to lead tip.
"Gods, it's heavy. Long, too. I bet if you shot someone with one of these, he'd stay down."
"Yes, a shell's a dangerous thing, but it can be pretty, too. Would you like to see a trick I can do with this one?"
"Sure."
I took it back and began to dance it from knuckle to knuckle, my fingers rising and falling in waves. Young Bill watched wide-eyed.
"How does thee do it?"
"The same way anyone does anything," I said. "Practice."
"Will you show me the trick?"
"If you watch close, you may see it for yourself," I said. "Here it is, and here it isn't." I palmed the shell so fast it disappeared, thinking of Susan Delgado, as I supposed I always would when I did this trick. "Now, here it is again." The shell danced fast, then slow, then fast again. "Follow it with your eyes, Bill, and see if you can make out how I get it to disappear. Don't take your eyes off it." I dropped my voice to a lulling murmur. "Watch, and watch, and watch. Does it make you sleepy?"
"A little," he said.
His eyes slipped slowly closed, then the lids rose again. "I didn't get much sleep last night."
"Did you not?
Watch it go. Watch it slow. See it disappear and then see it as it speeds up again." Back and forth the shell went. The wind blew, as lulling to me as my voice was to him. "Sleep if you want, Bill. Listen to the wind and sleep, but listen to my voice, too." "I hear you, gunslinger." His eyes closed again, and this time didn't reopen. His hands were clasped limply in his lap. "I hear you very well." "You can still see the shell, can't you, even with your eyes closed?"
"Yes, but it's bigger now. It flashes like gold."
"Do you say so?"
"Yes."
"Go deeper, Bill, but hear my voice."
"I hear."
"I want you to turn your mind back to last night. Your mind and your eyes and your ears. Will you do that?"
A frown creased his brow. "I don't want to.
It's safe. All that's happened. And besides, I'm with you."
"You're with me. And you have guns."
"So I do. Nothing will happen to you as long as you can hear my voice, because we're together. I'll keep thee safe. Do you understand that?"
"Yes."
"Your Da told you to sleep out under the stars, didn't he?"
"Aye. It was to be a warm night."
"But that wasn't the real reason, was it?"
"No, it was because of Elrod. Once he twirled the bunkhouse cat by her tail, and she never came back. Sometimes he pulls me around by my hair and sings, 'The Boy Who Loved Jenny.' My Da can't stop him because Elrod's bigger. Also, he has a knife in his boot. He could cut with it, but he couldn't cut the beast, could he?"
His clasped hands twitched.
"Elrod's dead, and I'm glad. I'm sorry about the others. And my Da, I don't know what I'll do without my Da, but I'm glad about Elrod. He won't tease me no more. He won't scare me no more. I seen it. Aye."
So he did know more than the top of his mind and let him remember. "Now you're out on the grays."
"On the grays?"
"Wrapped in your blanket and shinny."
"Shaddy."
"Your blanket and shaddy. You're awake, maybe looking up at the stars, at old star and old mother."
No, asleep," Bill said. "But the screams wake me up. The screams from the bunkhouse and the sounds of fighting.
Things are breaking and something's roaring.
What do you do, Bill?
I go down. I'm afraid to, but my da's in there. I look in the window at the far end. It's grease paper, but I can see through it well enough. More than I want to see, because I see... Mister, can I wake up?
Not yet. Remember that I'm with you.
Have you drawn your guns, mister?
He was shivering. I have, to protect you.
What do you see?
Blood. And a beast.
What kind? Can you tell?
A bear. One so tall its head reaches the ceiling. It goes up the middle of the bunkhouse, between the cots, you can, and on its back legs, and it grabs the men. It grabs the men and pulls them to pieces with its great long claws.
Tears began to escape his closed lids and roll down his cheeks.
The last one was Elrod. He ran for the back door, where the woodpile is just outside, you can. And when he understood it would have him before he could open the door and dash out, he turned around to fight. He had his knife. He went to stab it.
Slowly, as if underwater, the boy's right hand rose from his lap. It was curled into a fist. He made a stabbing motion with it.
The bear grabbed his arm and tore it off his shoulder. Elrod screamed. He sounded like a horse I saw one time, after it stepped in a gompa hole and broke its leg. The thing, it hit Elrod in the face with his own arm. The blood flew. There was gristle that flapped and wound around the skin like strings. Elrod fell against the door and started to slide down. The bear grabbed him and lifted him up and bit into his neck, and there was a sound. Mister, it bit Elrod's head right off his neck. I want to wake up now, please.
Soon. What did you do then?
I ran. I meant to go to the big house, but Cy Jefferson,
He what?
He shot at me. I don't think he meant to. I think he just saw me out of the corner of his eye and thought, I heard the bullet go by me. Whoosh! That's how close it was. So I ran for the corral instead. I went between the poles. While I was crossing, I heard two more shots. Then there was more screaming. I didn't look to see, but I knew it was Cy Jefferson screaming that time.
This part we knew from the tracks and the leavings, how the thing had come charging out of the bunkhouse, how it had grabbed away the four-shot pistol and bent the barrel, how it had unzipped the rancher's guts and thrown him into the bunkhouse with his proddies. The shot Jefferson had thrown at young Bill had saved the boy's life. If not for that, he would have run straight to the big house and been slaughtered with the Jefferson womenfolk. You go into the old hostelry where we found you.
Aye, so I do, and hide under the tack, but then I hear it coming.
He had gone back to the now way of remembering, and his words came more slowly. They were broken by bursts of weeping. I knew it was hurting him. Remembering terrible things always hurts. But I pressed on. I had to. For what happened in that abandoned hostelry was the important part, and young Bill was the only one who had been there. Twice he tried to come back to the then way of remembering, the ago. This was a sign that he was trying to struggle free of his trance, so I took him deeper. In the end, I got it all. The terror he'd felt as the grunting, snuffling thing approached, the way the sounds had changed, blurring into the snarls of a cat. Once it had roared, young Bill said, and when he heard that sound, he'd let loose water in his trousers. He hadn't been able to hold it. He waited for the cat to come in, knowing it would scent him where he lay, from the urine, only the cat didn't. There was silence, silence, and then more screaming. At first it's the cat screaming, and then it changes into a human screaming. High to begin with, it's like a woman, but then it starts to go down until it's a man. It screams and screams. It makes me want to scream. I thought. Think, I said. You think, Bill, because it's happening now. Only I'm here to protect you. My guns are drawn. I think my head will split open. Then it stops.
and it comes in.
It walks up the middle to the other door, doesn't it?
He shook his head. Not walks. Shuffles. Staggers, like it's hurt.
It goes right past me. He, now it's he. He almost falls down, but grabs one of the stall doors and stays up. Then he goes on. He goes on a little better now.
Stronger?
Aye.
Do you see his face?
I thought I already knew the answer to that.
No, only his feet through the tack. The moon's up, and I see them very well.
Perhaps so, but we wouldn't be identifying the skin man from his feet, I felt quite sure. I opened my mouth, ready to start bringing him up from his trance, when he spoke again.
There's a ring around one of his ankles.
I leaned forward, as if he could see me, and, if he was deep enough, mayhap he could, even with his eyes closed.
What kind of ring? Was it metal, like a manacle?
I don't know what that is.
Like a bridle ring? You know, a hossklinkum?
No, like on Elrod's arm, but that's a picture of a naked woman, and you can hardly make it out no more.
Bill, are you talking about a tattoo?
In his trance, the boy smiled.
Aye, that's the word. But this one wasn't a picture, just a blue ring around his ankle. A blue ring in his skin.
I thought, we have you. You don't know it yet, Psy Skin Man, but we have you.
Mister, can I wake up now? I want to wake up.
Is there anything else?
The white mark?
He seemed to be asking himself.
What white mark?
He shook his head slowly from side to side, and I decided to let it go. He'd had enough.
Come to the sound of my voice. As you come, you'll leave everything that happened last night behind, because it's over. Come, Bill. Come now.
I'm coming. His eyes rolled back and forth behind his closed lids.
You're safe. Everything that happened at the ranch is a go, isn't it?
Yes.
Where are we?
On Debaria High Road. We're going to town. I ain't been there but once. My dad bought me candy.
I'll buy you some, too, I said, for you've done well, young Bill of the Jefferson. Now open your eyes.
He did, but at first he only looked through me. Then his eyes cleared, and he gave an uncertain smile.
I fell asleep.
You did. And now we should push for town before the wind grows too strong. Can you do that, Bill?
Aye, he said. And as he got up, he added, I was dreaming of candy.
The two not-so-good deputies were in the sheriff's office when we got there. One of them, a fat fellow wearing a tall black hat with a gaudy rattlesnake band, taking his ease behind Peavy's desk. He eyed the guns I was wearing and got up in a hurry.
"You're the gunslinger, ain't ya?" he said. "Well met, well met. We both say so. Where's t'other one?"
I escorted young Bill through the archway and into the jail without answering. The boy looked at the cells with interest but no fear. The drunk, Salty Sam was long gone, but his aroma lingered. From behind me, the other deputy asked,
"What do you think you're doing, young Psy?"
"My business," I said. "Go back to the office and bring me the key ring to these cells, and be quick about it, if you please." None of the smaller cells had mattresses on their bunks, so I took young Bill to the drunk and disorderly cell, where Jamie and I had slept the night before. As I put the two straw pallets together to give the boy a little more comfort, after what he'd been through, I reckoned he deserved all the comfort he could get. Bill looked up at the chalk map on the wall.
"What is it, Psy?"
"Nothing to concern you," I said. "Now listen to me. I'm going to lock you in, but you're not to be afraid, for you've done nothing wrong. 'Tis but for your own safety. I have an errand that needs running, and when it's done, I'm going to come in there with you."
"And lock us both in," said he. "You better lock us both in case it comes back."
"Do you remember it now?"
"A little," he said, looking down. "It wasn't a man. Then it was. It killed my da."
He put the heels of his hands against his eyes.
Poor Da. The deputy with the black hat returned with the keys. The other was right behind him.